AutoLine After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone, passion for excellence.
This is AutoLine After Hours with John McElroy for episode 70, September 2nd, 2010, The Big Linguini Switch. Watch AutoLine After Hours live at AutoLineDetroit.tv every Thursday at 7 p.m. Eastern Time or 2300 hours GMT. You can subscribe to this podcast for free by searching for AutoLine After Hours in the iTunes Store. Well, welcome, everybody. Here we are, AutoLine After Hours, Thursday night again. And joining me, as always, is, with his inimitable presence, the auto extremist, Peter DeLorenzo.
Buongiorno, Johnny.
So good to have you here.
Glad to be here, as always.
And also, as I promoted you today, WDIV's ace reporter, Rod Maloney.
Okay, business editor is fine.
Business
but yes.
editor, okay. That's great.
But yes, thank you. I love being here. This is fun.
One of our local media stars.
Local media star, you know it.
Yeah, we need to get a better brand of star, I'm here to tell you.
And also joining us is Lonnie Miller from RL Polk, which is, how do you describe the
marketing company? Information, auto research, basically helping anyone in the auto business understand where the opportunity is and how to act on it.
And the company's been around a long
140
time.
140 years as an overall organization.
Say that again.
140 years.
Now, okay, so you were collecting data before the automobile.
Started doing car stuff in the 20s, but it started out with local community books. So Ralph Lane Polk.
Unreal.
Knew what the community businesses wanted to know, and then just that aspect of gathering information, and then it evolved with Mr. Henry Ford and Durant not trusting one another, so the story goes, and they said, Ralph, how about telling me what the other guy is really selling? And we go from there.
Yeah, I'll bet you they didn't trust each other at all. and probably with very good reason.
Yep. Right. Yep.
So. And also, we've got a little bit of a live audience with us tonight. We've got four students from Northwood University, and we'll probably hear some questions from them, too, when we get into the Q&A or the rapid-fire part of the program. But a lot of news to talk about. And, Rod, you were telling me that Dan Ackerson, the new CEO of General Motors, put out some sort of note today. What was that about?
Right. It was essentially a Labor Day message to the employees where he, you know, was sort of wishing them a happy Labor Day, sort of introducing himself, and was saying that he had met with Bob King and that his intent is to work with the unions. And I think he said something along the lines of, you know, not everybody gets everything they want, but, you know, you have my ear. And I'm paying attention so that I think he's trying to allay some of the fears because his reputation is that of quit complaining and get to work kind of attitude. And so I think that he sort of wants to get off on at least a good foot with his union workers. I suppose he can crack the whip with the white collar folks and get away with it. But the unions, I think he has to be a little bit more careful. So he's at least starting out in that
way. Well, they still own what? 19-20% of the company, right?
Yeah,
UAW's
right.
Got that much, so they could vote him out.
This is true. It seems highly unlikely, but you know, it wouldn't make sense for anybody to move. I think that the musical chairs on the deck there have stopped. Yeah. The music stopped, and everybody's going to kind of go ahead and do what they have to do because they can't.
We've just finished a two-week media blitz and PR blitz by GM for Ackerson.
So, Peter, you wrote about him this week.
Yeah, I mean, you know, the net-net of after all is said and done, I still haven't found one reason why he should be running General Motors.
I totally agree.
He's the best guy, the most acceptable choice for Wall Street. He happened to be the next guy up in the batter's on-deck circle. But after gleaning through all this stuff, reading about him, studying him, there's not one reason he should be running General Motors. So he is going to have to prove that he's just not another spineless financial weasel who has had this thing dumped on his lap, who has a reputation. Yeah, he went to the Naval Academy. He's a naval guy, you know, tough as nails, blah, blah, blah. But this business continues to be unlike any other business on Earth. So the jury is way out on whether he can do this.
Well, hopefully he's listening. You know, not only do the employees have his ear, but his lieutenants, you know, and he's going to really draw from that.
Well, as I said in my site, I said, you know, if the product people are talking and you don't know what they're talking about, just shut up and listen. Because we don't need someone coming up and trying to be an instant product expert. Not now. Yeah. Especially when GM has really got their stuff together. Yeah. Mark Royce has got everyone going in the same direction. Mm-hmm. They're on a product roll. He needs to understand what he doesn't know.
I think what is most fascinating about his ascendancy is that it tells you that it is still Government Motors, even though they're trying to say we're not Government Motors. And his ascension is like, you know, the prima facie case for politics in the boardroom, because he's not here at this time without reason. They want to get this IPO out. Right. They want to get below 50% ownership. And so he's the only guy that's going to have the respect on Wall Street. But it also gives the Democrats something to run on in the fall, saying that we're no longer in charge of Government Motors, even though, for all intents and purposes, they are, because it's still their guy in there. The biggest IPO ever was only, what, 18 or 19 billion. This one's going to be 19 or 20, and it still has them at, what is it, at 50 billion they still have in the company? Mm-hmm. So this guy is there, has nothing to do with the car business. It has everything to do with politics. There's no question in my mind about
that. They've said they're going to push back the IPO till after the elections.
Right, yeah. Which is probably smart. But here's my problem is, I think Akerson could be okay as a chairman, but not in charge of operations. And I'm sure you guys saw the story that they had this slam-bang, drag-out argument over whether General Motors really needed to develop a fully competitive global four-cylinder engine. Well, if you're in the car business and you got to argue with your CEO about whether you're going to do that, I think this is going to end very badly, very badly. So what I'm hoping is Whitaker goes in the end of December, Akerson becomes chairman, and then they get somebody who really is a CEO who knows how to run a car company.
Do they? I mean, is Royce ready? Or can they elevate somebody from within or not?
I think Royce needs more seasoning. I think he'll get there, no question, but he's still pretty young. What is he, 47 or something like that? That's pretty young to stick a guy in as CEO for that long a time.
Right.
You could go look at Nick Reilly, who runs Europe. But Nick's never run anything in the United States, and that's GM's home market. Plus, Europe is such a mess, they don't need more upheaval there. There's a guy named Tim Lee who's running Asia Pacific for them. Same thing. That's the growth path. Don't mess with that thing at all. So, I thought they should bring Fritz Henderson back, but it looks like we just got the news today. Fritz Henderson's going to work at Sunoco to do some sort of spinoff for a subdivision that they have there.
But why Fritz, get away from here.
Right. Well, he knows where he's not welcome. I mean,
I think he'd come back in a flash if they offered it to him. But I hear that he and Akerson were the ones arguing over the four-cylinder engine. So I don't think Fritz is going to get any invitation.
I knew that Whitaker was gone about 3 weeks before the announcement. And I mean this sincerely. Because I covered a news conference in downtown Detroit at the Blue Cross building. If you remember, Blue Cross was, which is across the street from the Rensen, the CEO was looking out and he saw the towers, the old EDS towers, and he said, you know what, I think I could move everybody into those buildings. And so he goes in and negotiates a deal. I mean, it's the deal of the century. This guy can't believe it. So they go do this big dog and pony show, and there's Ed Whitaker at this thing. And I'll try and approximate his seating style.
And for those on the webcast now, Rod is just like all splayed out all over the couch
and,
here.
And I kid you not, I mean, we laughed about it at the time. I said, that is a man who is not long for this town. He doesn't want to be at this news conference. He doesn't want to be in Detroit. He's clearly riding his tractor down on his ranch down in Texas. And I knew it then. And, in fact, a couple of days later, the president came to town, and some of the photographers
who
were there for President Obama came to town. And we were talking about it. I said, so how long do you think Whitaker's got? And the guy says, oh, you mean this picture? And he shows the picture shooting up Ed's, you know, size 15 shoe, you know, kind of leaning back like this. And it was obvious. It was absolutely obvious that he was done.
Was he pushed out?
I think he was pushed out to the degree that they all knew he didn't want to be there and that they had to have the consistency in the IPO.
Wall Street had to know who they were going to be dealing with.
So. I've heard other people say, yeah, there's the IPO, blah, 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 blah. I'm starting to hear there's a lot of talk now that the board asked Ackerson if he would be chairman and CEO. Not that Whitaker told them he was going.
Well, but everybody knew he didn't want the job, really. I mean,
that early he didn't plan on staying.
He didn't want to hang around a long time. You know, that's the vibe I ever got from Ed, and I've interviewed him several times, and he seems like a nice enough guy. But I just didn't get the impression that in, especially at the auto show, the last place in the planet Ed Whitaker wanted to be was in downtown Detroit in January. It just didn't agree with him. And he, you know, because, you know, we were discussing, you know, the weather extremes, you know, off camera before the cameras rolled. And, you know, I said, you know, I don't really like the heat. I prefer the cold. He said, but you never get used to the cold. And I said, oh, interesting little, you know, sort of insight into him. But I always felt like he came in at arm's length feeling like I'm going to teach all y'all how to do this. And he got into that boardroom and figured out this is actually quite complicated, and I'm not sure at my age I really want to be messing around with this anymore. That was always the vibe that I got from him. Now, I could be wrong, but that was the vibe that I got from him, and I never warmed up to the guy. I just didn't really.
Well, maybe that's why the board might have said, hey, let's find somebody who really wants
to
be.
They were reading it already.
But
themselves.
In his defense, who wants to be in Detroit in January?
Well, that's true.
Ask us. We live here.
Journalists do. 6,000 in
if
county.
Move the Detroit Auto Show to Austin, Texas, we would in January.
Yeah, he has the option, apparently.
Well, you know, another key reason why they've got to do this right is, to your point, Peter, GM's got a pretty good lineup of products right now. But I tell you, I've just spent this week test driving a Ford Mustang 5-liter GT, 6-speed manual. I am blown away at how good this car is. And, you know, everyone's raving about the engine, just over 400 horsepower. It's the whole package. And, you know, when I pulled out of the parking spot, not the parking lot, the parking spot, I don't even think I had gone 20 yards, and I stopped the car and I went, oh, my God, this thing is awesome. And that's very rare for that to happen in such a short amount of time. And what it is the take-up in the clutch and how it's balanced with the gas pedal and how you can heel and toe so very easily with the pedals. There's never been a Ford that's been this easy for heel and toe driving. The gear shift lever is just so precise. The steering's excellent. The one I'm driving has got this Brembo brake package.
Well, you got to get that if you get
one. It's another $1,600, but yeah. And the exhaust note, you know that you've got a powerful engine, but it's not loud. It's there. You hear it, and it sounds great. The steering, everything about the car. And so I'm going, oh, holy moly. I mean, you know, the Mustang's always been this American icon, but let's face it, it always had big engine. It was never a very sophisticated car. This thing is. I'd stack this up just about, not for the interior and everything, against a BMW M3. And that's really saying something.
Well, and that begs the question, because when you go back and you look at what Mullally has said all along about what he wants best in class.
Right.
Best car, best in class. He said that's what we're going to do. The question is, how did he get there? What have they done? Because if you look at their quality, it's not just crept up. It has leapt up and continues to crank up. Is it that they've cut cost? Is it that they're committed to it? What is it about this? And I don't know the answer. John, Peter, you know.
I got one answer. It's called Derek Cusack, who's the head of all product development at Ford now, and I think this guy's awesome.
Derek Cusack's the best product guy in the business. I think Alan Mullally is the best leader in the business, and he has been able to focus the organization.
Yeah, I think their culture change.
It's a fundamental culture change. I mean, Ford was filled with silos and fiefdoms, and Alan came in, and he has done a tremendous job. And to get that organization all focused in the same direction was an accomplishment unto itself. However, he's taken that much further than that.
Well, and you remember they always talked about the middle kingdom. You know, the middle kingdom always sort of staunching any good idea and just killing it. But I think what's more remarkable about what they've done is it's not just that he took the silos and made it one company, pointed it in one direction, and got them going. That's an operational issue. But the cars are better, too. It's you know, to get the organization is difficult enough, but to get the cars right, too, is staggering in its achievement.
But I think you said a key point there, Rod, when everybody knows exactly what they're supposed to do, and they've made it, one Ford. You know, there's none of this Jaguar, Premier Automotive Group, all this other kind of stuff going on. Everyone's knows what they've got. I've had people at Ford tell me for the first time they really feel like they're working on the right stuff up and down the company. And then the other thing, too, is Ford is definitely putting more money into the product. They're cutting costs on a global basis, but they're spending the money to put nice materials in there, the latest technology in there. And before, in the old Detroit model, you know, the push model, where you had to push metal out the door, whether there were customers or not, and you couldn't get pricing, so you'd made the product as cheap as possible, those days are gone. I mean, this is transformational. And that's why, you know, in the discussion here, to me, when I see Ford going so good, it's GM, you got good product right now.
Oh, well,
but man, you got to just keep the pedal to the metal, because
the other part of it is they evangelize superbly right now. Ford is just doing a great job of having fun, making you feel good about being engaged. They're doing a great job of getting people in the bowels of the organization to talk about it more easily and aggressively. So just the whole word of mouth and the, you know, try one type of referral system, they're just doing great. And, you know, Jim Farley's got a not only sales and service he's got to worry about, but there's a lot that he's putting together coming over from Toyota.
If you think about it, too, in the end, when you look at the achievement that's here, it tells you that Detroit Metal can be every bit as good as anybody else's. It can lead the way if you unleash the potential of the people who inhabit the glass house, who inhabit the Rensen, who are up in Auburn Hills. Domestic 3 metal can be just as good as anybody else's on the planet if given the opportunity. And maybe now that we've removed the shackles of all the legacy costs, that can give all three the opportunity to, you know, show what it is that we can do. Let's hope.
Well, we'll have to see the results, but I'd say Ford's putting down the results right now. GM's not that far behind them. I don't think they're that far behind. And
well, they got a long way to go in terms of marketing. Ford is Allen's got the best team. You know, they've got Farley. You mentioned Derek. I think his team is tremendous, deep, talented, and their designers are just getting cranking. GM's designers are ahead.
I agree.
Design group is one of the best in the world. But Ford is really rededicating themselves to upping the ante there.
Another guy that I'd throw into that mix, too, Peter, is Gerhard Schmidt, who runs Ford's science labs, the Sci Labs, as they call it. Because when you look at the technology they have right now, Sync, my Ford Touch. Yeah. Ford Sync has been out for, I think, 3 years now, and no one else has got it.
No one's called them.
I mean, Hyundai's just about to get there. But just as Hyundai's about to get there, Ford goes, boom, here's my Ford Touch or my Lincoln Touch, and kick it up to another level.
And when you consider that, you know, frankly, a lot of the young drivers want the Focus because they've got the Sync. You drop the thing in,
right, boom,
and have a nice day. So are you going to get, you know, you're going to go something small from GM that doesn't have that, or are you going to go with the Focus? The kid's going, Dad, I want that. Mom, I want that.
Exactly.
It's just a fundamental cool factor.
Hey, the other news that came out this week, of course, we just got all the numbers fully last night and this morning, was August sales. And Lonnie, how do you read it? Everyone's portraying this as, oh, my God, disaster. We're down so much from a year ago. And I'm saying, who cares?
Right, right.
I say, forget 2009. Don't compare it to that.
You know, August sales, some people were watching, knowing what we did last year this time with Cash for Clunkers. So your comparison is off the Richter scale, so you got a little more of a normal August as the recovery's going, so you're down. And the automakers were comparing themselves to the previous year, same month, but at the same time, there's still overall progress with year-to-date compared to, and they're still projecting the industry to still be above from last year. Cash for Clunkers was an aberration. You sold first time last August. It's the first time in 14 months, I think, at that point, that they broke 1 million unit sales. So everyone was like, fantastic. Hangover in the following month in September of 2009. So we're back on our increase. Mm-hmm. So you know, August comes out, and, you know, virtually everyone's reporting out their sales, but at the same time, you've got to take a look at where's the long term. You know, forget the month over month and forget the month to month previous. Look at the year to date and see what the projection is. It's funny when people talk about SAR. So they said, okay, August really fell. SAR is going to be down to, what, 10, 5?
Who said that? I don't remember seeing that.
Three other agencies are saying
really?
Most of the people who are putting a little more discipline into it, I mean, our projection is still 11.5, 11.7.
Sure, and I think the rate is still 11.4 right now.
Speak. But they said with August numbers being so low, it depressed that. And it's a temporary, it's a blip in terms of the
pace. When you hear people talking about month-to-month sales, they'd probably, you know, they are so insignificant.
Right.
You look for trends over the year, which is, I believe, to be correct. And the whole thing, this is the vagary of the year-to-year comparison
right. When
you've got cash for clunkers out there. I thought, though, when I did my coverage of it, that Chrysler, we thought, was dead a year ago because they didn't do anything in cash for clunkers. They're the ones that can be happy because they're showing, 7% year-to-year, right? Up, I think it was 7%, right?
For 8 months.
So it's like, you know, they're starting to slowly but surely show that we're not dead. We're here. People are buying their cars. They were within like 400 units of 100,000. I mean, that's big for them.
And
so
they ran out of inventory last year early for cash for clunkers.
So, you know, so the nice story that came out of the whole thing was that Chrysler's not dead.
Right.
They've got a pulse. They're moving vehicles. And I actually enjoyed telling that story because I just am so tired of talking about dead car companies.
You know, I think it's even better than what you're talking about because if you go month over month, mm-hmm. July to August, Chrysler was actually up 15%.
Right.
And they captured 10% market share.
Right.
It is the second best month they've had all mm-hmm. year long. Right. And as we keep talking about on the show, they got not a very good lineup in the showroom,
right.
to put it
waiting.
Kindly.
Yep.
And so if they can gain share and sales and be at an operating profit with junk in the showroom, wait till they get new stuff in there.
Well, and you know, they're still a ways away from that, and that's still a problem for them. But, you know, I think that people are looking around, and when you go shopping and you say, okay, well, the moms are looking for a minivan, and do I go, you know, domestic? Do I go foreign? What do I do? And I know that you drove the Odyssey this week, and that's supposed to be
this afternoon.
The best, you know, minivan on the planet. But Chrysler still has that feeling that it's still a good vehicle.
Right.
They're selling a lot of those. The dealers are telling me they can't keep the Chargers and the Challengers in the parking lot, and they think that they're going to make a lot of hay selling cop cars. So, you know, there's this notion that, you know, they've got a little momentum going. Now, they're not going to beat, they're not overtaking Toyota anytime soon.
Right.
But they're showing some signs of life is very encouraging.
You know, it's a different game when, you know, it's very cliche, but everyone seems to be really true about saying profitable mm-hmm. share, not highest share,
mm-hmm.
because we saw what happens when you try to just go for unit sales, and you can't run a business that way. So the report card comes out, you know, on the financials, report card comes out to others just looking at it in terms of just who's got the highest market, you know, penetration, but that ladder isn't really what they're paid on.
Lonnie, one of the things the Detroit Three are heavily criticized for is how many fleet sales they go after.
Yeah.
Give us a snapshot of the market, fleet versus retail.
Yeah, fleet retail. I mean, so if you're a general consumer like all of us, you know, 8 out of 10 units are retail, what you and I would normally transact and pick up at the dealership. So you hear that fleet number of about 20%. I think last year it was around 18%. It's around 22.
Total market,
total
roughly
market, US,
20%.
Yeah, 80-20 principle on that. And then your mind goes, if you're looking at fleet and you kind of say, well, look at all that rental. But you forget that fleet is also government and commercial. And for the brands that sell utilities and very utilitarian type of needed vehicles, they do quite well with commercial. And that commercial business is great. It's gravy and it's long-term mm-hmm. good annuity, you know, when they have those large companies.
And doesn't this actually show us, though, that we are in a different era now? Because when they had the legacy costs around their neck, they had to, you know, juggle any which way they could to either show that they were doing well or moving metal. And so if you shove it into the fleet, at least we're moving some metal.
Sure, sure. It's just,
well, now that the legacy costs aren't there, then maybe the measure of success doesn't necessarily have to be looked at, or the measure of failure, as fleet sales.
Right.
So maybe, you know, there are some new ways for us to look at this as we go forward, because maybe fleet sales aren't as important to the sort of shell game that they used to play when their sales numbers would come out.
I mean, in 06, Ford and GM were saying, you know, we're really going to take the break on fleet sales overall. And, you know, you used to look at just some of the long-term trends. 07, you can really see where Detroit, they got humbled about it, and they started acting seriously about not putting a lot into fleet. And most of fleet still is rental, but they are trying to recover without having to, you know, just rely just on that, mm-hmm. on that part. Mm-hmm. So it's a little bit of a misconception. I get frustrated when you hear other analysts talk about, oh, fleet's bad, fleet's bad, fleet's bad. No, it's not. Not if you know the mix, and not if you've got a good combination with commercial. Mm-hmm. And you've got small and large commercial accounts. And these guys, you know, they manage it very well.
Very predictable business.
Very much so, yeah. Government, you know, fleet orders can be very predictable, like a straight arrow, you know. But in general, the rental business, you know, it's funny. If you look at some of the Asian brands, they really were trying to build share, you know, Hyundai and Kia. And a lot of people were saying, well, I'm seeing a lot of their units in rental fleet, or a lot of their units in rentals. But even they know the sins of the past from Detroit. They don't want a piece of that either. So I don't think anyone's really into just doing the rental dumping game anymore.
Speaking of Kia, I got to drive the new Kia Optima this week, and, man, I was impressed. You know, I've driven the Hyundai Sonata. This is built on the same platform, same powertrain. Mechanically, they're almost identical.
Different designer.
A different designer. Peter Schreyer, who used to be at Audi.
Yeah.
And to my eye, and I love the Sonata. I think it's a terrific car. But I think this, in fact, we've got it up on the screen now. Ben's got it up there. This is a very sophisticated design. And, I mean, Kia used to be a joke.
Right.
I mean, it's just
mm-hmm.
bland, cheap cars. And now these things are turning out really good. And the interiors knock out good, too. And so here we've been talking so much about Hyundai and how much they've been, you know, climbing up the ladder here. I think Kia is going to surprise a lot of people.
It's funny, when I was in China 3 years ago almost. We had a conference where we were talking to the Chinese domestic manufacturers there about exporting. So we have operations in Beijing, and they wanted a case study on an Asian brand that had come to North America and see how they did. So we profiled Hyundai. And a lot of people still, I don't think, in America realize, you know, it's been, what, north of 25 years that Hyundai's been, you know, here in the States, if you're not really, you know, tracking. But one thing that fascinated us when we were showing them is that their customer satisfaction for the Hyundai brand and their owner loyalty metrics were like mirror images of one another. So the bad cliche impression of junky Korean cars on the road, you know, their improvement in terms of overall satisfaction, the stuff that was tracked by U of M and their American Customer Satisfaction Index. But owner loyalty rates, just repeat purchase, tracked with satisfaction, huge. I mean, 20-point increases over a decade. And, you know, it continues with their quality ratings that you read, too. Mm-hmm. So that's going to speak volumes in terms of people's desire to even entertain for a first-time trial.
Which goes back to your point about GM had better be on the game, because the market, the market is getting ever tougher. You've got, everybody's got to be good.
Right.
Good is get you out the door. You know, excellent and, you know, superior is the stuff that's going to win this thing in the end.
Right. Lonnie, talk a little bit about the used car market, because we've seen such a change in the last year due to the collapse of the new car market.
Used cars should be a good substitute, people conventionally will think, because I don't want to pay as much for a new. So even though financing's harder, to, you know, your interest rate's going to be a little higher on a used car. But one of the things that we've been looking at is the relationship for every one new vehicle sold, how many used. So it used to be a 3-to-1 ratio. Three used, you know, one new, three used. Heyday, probably up until about 07, you're seeing 45, 47 million used vehicles. You're down into the mid-30s, you know, these days. But that depression of new units, too, it gives you a sense that it's not a 3-to-1 ratio used to new. It's more like a 4-to-1 ratio. So that shift, that kind of substitution.
So even though used car sales are down, and proportionately used more people are buying used.
Yeah, and the used prices, you know, keep getting reported. Edmunds was talking about, you know, how their price
How about
points.
Certified pre-owned?
Wonderful programs, and they were always bucking. If you, you know, go back and look at the headlines and news, CPO certified programs were always doing well. I think either Volkswagen or Audi reported one of their best CPO months, either last month or the month before. It's a wonderful alternative for a near new, and it's a good option for someone that says, I still don't want to pay through the nose if I'm, you know, just from a price sensitive standpoint.
I did a piece a while back, a couple of months ago, about how if you really shop it, and especially with the incentives where they have been, and this may even go back a year because I bought my wife's car about 18 months ago, and we shopped used.
Okay.
And we put it up against the new, and the used was within like $1,000 or less. And I'm going, well, this is just stupid. We bought the new car because it was a better deal than the used car. And I think that it, to this day, people assume that a used car is going to be a better deal. And I would advise you to shop very carefully.
It's better actually, shop now because prices have been going up all year long.
Shot you back to new, and that's good for that. Yeah. You know, the one thing you see is with the increasing sales volumes with the European and the Asian brands, you see that making its way within the used market too. So the top used vehicles in terms of share for used cars, used trucks, it's the Toyota, Hondas, you know, they are taking that as well in there. So it's just that consumer preference to see what's
But I got to believe, just looking at the sales numbers, that Toyota has taken a hit on owner loyalty. And I don't know, there seems to be like this almost symbiosis between Toyota and Honda. As Toyota slides down, it's almost like out of sympathy, Honda is sliding down too.
You know, the we did a piece that we released last month, and we'll do articles on just kind of microcosms of what some of the auto companies are doing. And so everyone knows about the recall that Toyota went through. So we wanted to see, all right, how did repeat sales and owner loyalty pan out at the beginning? It was pretty much first quarter of this year. Interesting thing is, so in the late 09, but as you moved into the January and February period, their retention really took a dive, but in March it bounced right back up. And they bought a lot of, you know,
with
business
incentives.
With incentives, which tells you that if I heard that much grief about a car company with the recall that the spotlight was on, and you'll give me money, and they, I mean, they had huge showroom traffic, and they were bouncing back up. What that tells you is that they've got excellent past equity. People forgave them in a sense.
Has that continued through the year?
Absolutely. Yeah, they're one of the top five loyal brands as of the
first quarter. But here's my question. Okay, Toyota's got probably the best brand loyalty of a mass market brand.
Right, right.
But it's still 50%.
Right, and that's
i.e., they need 50% conquest, and I believe those people didn't have the loyalty.
Honda's been getting the conquests. Honda's been eating others' lunches. So that whole pattern, that churn, you know, and some parts of the year it's seasonal, but on average, you know, brand loyalty could be as low as 45, 49% if you look at it from a overall corporate entity like General Motors, include Toyota, Scion, Lexus. Mm-hmm. It could be as high as 55, 56. But rule of thumb is, you know, for every one you got, you lost one, so you're always on that treadmill, and that's expensive. That's really expensive.
It strikes me, one of the things that I've been hearing is in my travels is that the Gen Y, Gen coming along, rode around in Mom's Camry. And when it's time now for them to go look for a car, they're not interested in a Camry.
Right. We've,
you know, I see that.
The numbers show that.
Yeah. The younger demographics, you know, sub 35, fickle. There are some ethnic groups that are even more fickle. We've seen Hispanic Americans, like, whatever, man. It's not.
Whatever's hot.
What you do see some consistency with are folks probably north of 55, 65, kind of age bands, but they're tired of the cross shopping. They're winding down, whether they're traditional marketers will say that empty nester standpoint. So they might downsize. They've had a lot of experience. They don't have that affinity or that sense of not even maybe obligation. But, yeah, youth are not interested in necessarily driving what mom or dad or what they were sitting in. But you do see that with some of the older population. And part of it is the dealer experience.
Well, hopefully that's the key, because I think people shop and they get to know their dealers. And it's much easier to call.
That's the make or break area.
Call Jack down at, you know, the local Chevy or Ford store or whatever, and they know him. They visit. What do you want to do? And that's much more important to them.
Yeah, we've done research where literally the evidence was showing some of the customers we were talking to and said, you know, it makes a difference when the service technician comes out into the service advisor's desk area and talks to you in plain English about what he did to your car. And then the follow-up rating, say, okay, why did you feel good? You know, it was just trust, right? It's that human aspect of it. So the retail experience is huge in terms of driving, because you screw around the dealer loyalty, buying again at the store, you might get some forgiveness up to a point, you know, with the brand, but they go to another dealer and it's sour. Good night.
Are you seeing a digital divide in those customers, i.e. Gen X, Gen Y being into social media, boomers not? How's that playing out?
Yep. Yeah, I think we were talking about, you know, Ford's advertising and being a really good evangelist, if you will, just all the tools that they're pulling out of their marketing box. They know they've got to talk to that, because you have, you know, there's a term some people use called digital natives. And then there's us, digital immigrants. And, you know, we're sitting there. We got into it. We get it. But we weren't there all along from birth, if you will. Mm-hmm. So the way in which they're talking to them in terms of that engagement factor, the whole social media, I think we're just seeing it. I mean, just the fact how we're doing this.
And I'll tell you, you know, down the road, John, you and I are going to be going off the grid. Because we're all going to be locked in our little pods on those electronic guides. And that's when you go out at night and your V8 powered something, and you can only run at night off the grid, no GPS, no electronics that they can track you.
Right.
That's right. We're going to have stealth ceramic body panels to deflect the radar, too.
I think the social media wave, North America is getting the benefit of the maturity of it and all the tools and things, you know, online shopping and what other people are trying to report and connect with sales prediction. But Europe and Asia, you know, they're going to get later. They're probably not up to speed as to what we're seeing here in the U.S. in terms of all the tools and the marketing messages. I mean, you know, how long has American Idol been throwing forward, you know, vehicles at the contestants?
Mm-hmm. Many seasons.
Absolutely, you know.
I'll tell you, the biggest worry of some of the visionaries that spend their days at the auto companies thinking about stuff like that, the biggest worry is kids don't care about cars.
Yeah. That's right. And we're seeing that in Asia. It's a big problem in Japan right now.
Yeah, huge worry. I mean, it's just like, you know, they're more interested in this.
Right. Well, you know, that's where I think Ford's so smart. And again, here we come back to Ford again. But,
That MyTouch, have you played with that at all?
A little bit. I haven't. Yeah, I got to spend more time with
it. It's wild.
You know, as I've talked about before, what impresses me so much is Ford's had this for 3 years and no one else has got it. Mm-hmm. As I said, Hyundai's about to get it. But the way that Ford did it was, you know, first they teamed up with Microsoft and boom, they made sync happen. Then to go to the next step, they went to the contract manufacturers in Taiwan. And instead of designing everything and said, you know, here, quote this, they said, it's got to be about, you know, this deep and that high and this wide. That's what it's got to fit in. Make it happen. And, oh, by the way, we'll put the software in, because that's really the intellectual property that counts. And so, boom, 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 now they got my Ford Touch. They've got open source software, so you can develop apps. Ford's going to control the apps that go into it. They're taking the page right out of Apple's book.
Right.
But again, Ford's got to be another 3 years ahead of everybody else on this. And to me, that's really saying something when none of the luxury European brands has anything like this. None of the Japanese brands have anything like this. The Koreans are coming to the United States to buy the technology to bring back. And I'm, again, you know, this shows me that, you know, Mulally's just not smiles and hugs. There's something really fundamental changing in that company.
You know, what it seems like is that if you're open source development and it's that collaboration, but frankly, I'm willing to take a risk as a car company and invite you to kind of help build. And there's so much talked about it in terms of the experience. Mm-hmm. And if, you know, tomorrow's generation isn't going to want to have cars, they're going to want to have good experience. You look at the job market and in terms of where Gen Y employees. They'll say, I'll follow the manager. I'm not loyal to the company. But if I had a good and they looked out for me and they gave me autonomy, teleworking, all of those other mega trends in terms of how people work, you look at the demographic and what they're saying and how it's changing how companies work with their employee base, extend that to how cars are being built and who's going to, you know, ask who to have input on that. And I think it's just, it's a trust factor and make it a fun experience on top of it.
But I agree with Peter. I think we should both get Mohawks and Road Warrior, you know, vehicles and go out at 2 o'clock in the morning and rip it up.
It's going to come to that, I'm telling you. We'll have to go out of the urban areas to get off the...
Yes, we will.
The grids.
That's right. Well, hey, I think it's time that we get to our audience here and bring them into the program. And Ben, let's bring up Rapid Fire. Oh, and guess what? I'm not even ready here.
Let's do a phone call.
Let's do a phone call. That's a great idea.
Hey, guys, just wanted to say great job on the Dream Cruise coverage. That was a lot of fun. You got to do that again next year.
We will.
This question is for Peter. The last couple of after-hour shows, you've been alluding to this phenomenally spectacular product that Lincoln has coming. So I'm assuming you've probably seen some of it, and I realize you can't talk about it specifically, but please tell me Ford is smart enough to realize that they need more than one rear-drive car in the United States. They've got the Falcon in Australia. I'm hoping that if not the car itself, at least the next generation platform will come over here and be put either in a Ford showroom or a Lincoln showroom. But they can't possibly think that they can go front-wheel drive only for Lincoln and be successful. So, Peter, any help you can give us, greatly appreciate it. And this is Frank from Bridgeton, New Jersey. Thanks.
Hey, Frank. No, they don't, you know, believe me, we've just got through talking about how Ford is really buttoned up and focused. And the good thing about what they've done on Lincoln is they've decided, they've done all the internal hand-wringing, they've pulled all the constituencies within, they've talked to the Ford family, and they want Lincoln to not only survive, but thrive. Right. So, you know, I've been privy to some of the advanced design work they've done on the cars, which is really good, really good.
But isn't it a raging debate inside Ford now? How serious? Are we really going to go take on Mercedes and BMW?
Oh, yeah.
Are we really... And are we going to take this brand global? And I got to believe this is a raging debate inside
the
company.
Yeah, but I think the take the brand global thing, I think that just choice is made for them. They have to. If they're going to invest, they're going to have to take it to China. It's going to have to live in other regions of the world.
Buick's seen as a premium brand.
So,
throughout China.
Well, and I look at it, all you need to know about that question is the fact that they pulled the plug on Mercury.
Right.
Yeah.
That's it. You got two.
So they're,
hey, we're a global car company. Have a nice day.
Yeah, they're all in. So, Frank, hang tight.
George from Brooklyn wants to know, what does the panel think of Fiesta sales this month? And I just got them here. They sold 3,300 cars, which is not very much.
Yeah. Well,
I think it's only getting going.
Yeah, they've had the huge issues in Mexico with the...
they had some part problem.
Well, disruption of train travel because of storms and stuff. And so it hasn't gotten going yet, but the car has been, best I can tell, favorably received by just the average walk into the dealer and look at it, buy it type of.
They look good on the street.
Yeah,
I see them, and they've got them in all these bright colors, mm-hmm. so you can't miss them as they come down.
Out. Yeah, mm-hmm. probably a couple more months, you start really seeing where the slope mm-hmm. kicks in and new launches that within that first
quarter. You know, we just had this another oil platform explosion in the Gulf. I'm telling you. If we get a spike in gas prices, a Fiesta is going to be looking real good.
Right.
And we will. I have no doubt we're going to get it.
Mark O'Grady, he's got a question for you, Lonnie. He says his question is hypothetical in nature, but based on customer loyalty or brand resonance, if GM were ever to bring back a brand name in a utopian future, which brand should they bring back? No, Mark votes for Pontiac.
Not the Corvair.
Well, that's a model.
That's a model. Yeah, it's not a nameplate.
Yeah. You know, Pontiac, there's a part of me that my heart weeps for Saturn.
Saturn was a brilliant marketing.
It absolutely was, you know, from a retail experience, and it's not too long gone. But, you know, in terms of, you know, you look at where Mark Royce is really, he's passionate, you know, racing enthusiast. You know, that had to have hurt from what Pontiac could have represented, you know, in terms of that, you know, any man's, you know, accessible, you know, performance, you know, line, so to speak. So my bet would be on Pontiac, just in terms of the, you know, G8 and some of the other.
I think we might see down the road a model, you know, sold through the GMC dealers, you know. Yeah.
I agree. I think they could absolutely do that. I think maybe more than a model.
Yeah, it would be a couple.
Performance cars, very sophisticated performance cars. Why not? Mm-hmm. Steve writes in to say, how many bananas do you think Ford used in the exhaust to calculate horsepower and torque ratings on the F-150 with the 5-liter engine? I'm not sure what he's getting at there. Is the
he's saying it's underperforming?
Well, I wonder if the F-150 horsepower is lower than what it is in the Mustang. So you stumped us. You stumped us, Steve. Bill Bowen writes in to say, speaking of Europe, what's the deal with Opel thinking about expanding into Australia? That makes no sense to me with Holden in Australia. Is Opel going to Australia? No. That's news to me.
That was the headline I did for you the other day, that Opel was going global.
See what happens when I go out of town?
Yeah,
I missed all the news.
I remember the headline.
So Holden's going to sell some Opels? I don't know. Who knows what they're thinking there?
I don't know what they're thinking. Hey, let's go to another phone call here, Ben.
Good evening, men. This is Youngblood in Cleveland, Ohio, calling.
All right.
Last week you had a after-hours meeting with Joe Sarah, and everybody was in agreement that one of the casualties of GM's bankruptcy was the demise of the Hummer division.
Yes.
And then along with that, later on in the conversation, a fact came out that Lincoln was looking for a global presence. They wanted to be a global player. I just had a thought that maybe something like Hummer's HX might be the game changer for Lincoln. I just wonder what you guys think. You know, it could be the best in class, and I wonder if you guys had Derek Kuzek and Alan Mulally's phone number. Give him a call. See what he thinks about it. Then best wishes to David Walsh and his wife on their ventures to China. I hope everything goes well.
Yeah,
nice
thanks.
Talking to you. Have a good evening.
Can you put EcoBoost in a Hummer?
I think if Ford or Lincoln wanted to do that, they won't need to go to the HX. They could do their own.
Yeah.
And I think they have some smaller crossovers in the works.
I think it would contradict their strategy, you know, Lincoln as a brand, but also just where they're really trying to have a good focus on the efficiency. A Hummer-esque type of thing is going to blow that impression, and it's going to make them look bad in terms of their game plan.
And $4 a gallon gasoline would cinch that deal, I think.
Right.
George from Brooklyn's got a couple of questions here. He said, why did Jaguar do so well in August? And I think it all comes down to the new XJ is finally out and available, and anytime you have new product, it always helps sales.
Yeah. And I'm kind of interested to see this concept sports car they're going to show at Paris.
Oh, they are, eh?
They're going to show, it's supposedly going to be the concept for their next sports car.
Oh, well, we'll definitely have to keep an eye on
that. That's going to be interesting.
Put it in a Bond movie.
So Jim Haynes writes in to say, so let me get this straight. About 150 dealers talked to Chrysler, Fiat at a meeting where they were told what they would have to be able to do to sell Fiats at the dealerships. So how does the 50,000 sales target for the first year of Fiat 500s come from so few dealers if they all sign up?
You know, I got to tell you, whatever Sergio is drinking or smoking, it is really good. Because, you know, I wish them the best. I love the little Fiat 500. When I was in Paris last, the thing looks great. but I just don't know how they're going to get there. I just don't.
50,000 units is crazy in my mind.
And 50,000 taken out of somebody else's hide.
Right.
It's not like they're asleep at the wheel out there.
Right.
It's not like you're going to just pull your big linguine switch and it's all going to be good. So, you know, I applaud the guy. He's a bright guy, and the whole glass half full thing's great. But give me a break.
They're overselling it at 50,000. I mean, look, they're putting 2 and 3 cars in the showroom. How are you going to get 50,000 out of a showroom that's that size? Now, I talked to half a dozen dealers about what they're going to do. They all want to get this thing, which surprised me.
Dealers are dealers.
You know, I mean, I had one dealer showing me exactly what he was going to do to his building to make the Fiat showroom if he got it. I thought that was pretty cool. But it's, you know, there are only going to be 2 dealerships. In fact, if you look at their numbers, it's 2 dealerships a state. So how are you going to get 50,000 units out of that?
Let's just say, even if the frenzy was as strong as the Mustang was in 1964, they still can't sell 50,000. They just don't have the wherewithal. It's just so that's why, you know, people say, oh, you're too hard on Sergio. No, I'm not too hard on Sergio. I just want the rhetoric dialed back a little bit. It's much better to under-promise and over-deliver.
Right. Well, but let's realize one thing. Sergio never said anything to a guy like me about 50,000. He said it to his dealers, and they swore the dealers to secrecy. I'm banging on my phone trying to just, you know, with a shoehorn, pull the information out of these guys because they were sworn to secrecy.
Yeah, but, you know.
And they did. They did spill after a while. But the point is that Sergio isn't coming out in public and saying that. He's just saying it to his guys in-house, and it's a sales job that he's got to do.
Yeah.
I'm not defending the guy. I'm just saying that.
I don't know. I'm with Peter. Dial back the rhetoric.
Well,
under-promise.
Right.
But tell the world, maybe we can sell 10,000, and if you do 15, everyone thinks you're a genius.
Well, but I think for the first year, I think he's kind of more. They would like to get to 50, but my recollection of my notes was that they weren't going to do 50,000 out of the gate. It was going to be much lower.
50,000 could be what comes out of that plant in Mexico, because remember, it's going to Mexico, and it's going through all of South America as well, including Brazil, which is red hot right now. So if you say 50,000 Cinquecentos out of Toluca, I can buy that number.
But that's not what was said.
Right.
I know. Well.
And he's also the guy that said, well, we could easily sell 65,000 Alfa Romeos in the United States.
he said that, and that is true. And they even talked to, I had one dealer tell me that Alfa Romeo came out every other sentence. Well, we're not going to do Alfa Romeo, but Alfa Romeo, Alfa Romeo, Alfa Romeo. And it was, you know, 2 years out, they're talking about putting Alphas in the same showroom or, you know, do something similar with it. So
yeah, but
no,
that requires relaunching the brand
absolutely.
In the U.S., and we all know how much that costs.
That's wild. Yes.
And if you look at the competitive side on these mini, micro, small, subcompact, I mean, between now and 2012 or 13, base models out of the 40-some new models that are supposed to hit here, I think we're counting 31 of them.
Great
were
point.
In those two segments.
Great
alone.
Point.
Right.
So,
no
it's not like it's sitting, the new 500 is not sitting.
That segment's a buster for them.
Right.
It's coming into the pack where others are piling
that's
into
a great
it.
Point.
And the only way they're ever going to do that kind of volume is when the economy, if it ever does, you know, I think we're going to have a double dip. If once we get out of whatever trench we're in and we start ticking up, you're going to see gas prices go up. You will see $4 a gallon gasoline eventually. Yeah. And that's the only scenario that you're going to see, you know, the A and B segment doing that kind of number.
Right.
The only scenario.
Hey, I think we've got a question from one of the students from Northwood University here. Come on up. Steve, tell them who you are and let's hear the question.
My name is Steve Van Arsa. I'm a senior at Northwood University. My question is, it seems like a hot race between Toyota or with Lexus, Mercedes, and BMW. Who do you think is going to finish the year out number one?
Ooh.
Well, let's ask the guy who counts the number. Bonnie?
We were looking at this last month. And
Which client do you want to piss off?
No, that's fine. Premiums are good. Bets on Lexus by a hair.
Really?
I'm betting on BMW.
Me too.
Yeah,
I'm betting on.
We were looking at the run rate. And
In fact, BMW's been ahead of Lexus, I think, the last 3 months running.
They were.
In fact, I got the numbers right here. I should look it up.
When I saw the Lexus number yesterday, I went, gee, that seems small to me. That was a small number last month.
I think they're just far more competitive in there, you know, from a pricing standpoint. And everyone's saying the last half of this year is going to be a lot cooler. But I'd keep an eye. I went throw it in. I'll say Lex.
Well, you know, I got to be careful here because the numbers I'm looking at. BMW did 23,900. Let's call it 24,000. But that includes Mini in the numbers that I'm quoting.
Oh, that's the group.
So that's the group, right? Lexus did 19,500 roughly. Mercedes did about 20,000. That includes Smart, but that doesn't skew the numbers very much. So, yeah, I think if you subtracted, you could be right. It could be very close between subtracting Mini from
the numbers.
If you
look at BMW, the difference between the two, but you might be within a couple thousand. It might be that close.
But BMW's been catching Lexus, I think. The big Mos on BMW.
And they were, I think they were virtually, they were only down maybe a percent for previous
But Peter and I have been talking about their vehicles, and you know, BMWs are good, but they are starting to lose the core essence of what the brand stood for.
We're concerned about the
big
new 5.
And heavy.
We're concerned about the new 5. I drove a 550 that didn't have the sport package, and I was shocked. It was a nice car, but it didn't feel like a BMW. It was almost Lexus-like.
Really?
Right.
Now, from what I understand, John drove a 535 with the sport package, and I'm going to drive that car tomorrow, a different car. But I hope it feels like a BMW.
What's the unsung heroes from a benchmarking standpoint in the premium brands? Audi is the one everyone wants to engineer.
No question.
No, Audi's.
I want an Audi.
They are so red hot right now.
Amazing.
You talk to 9 out of 10 executives in the car business in Detroit, what they would get if they weren't driving for their homie their company. Audi's usually one or two on their list.
And that's how I go too, because you know the analysts that I talk to, they either drive them or they want them. And there's no doubt about that. And I think their ad campaign right now, with mom breaking to you the bad news that BMW isn't nearly as good, is, I think, brilliant. I think it's a great, great campaign. Yep.
And here's the exclamation point. Month over month, Audi was up 27% last month. And even if you do year over year, they were up 18%.
They're not dealing.
Right.
Yeah, they're getting full bore.
So very impressive. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Hey, Ben, let's bring in another phoner.
Hey, John. Great show. Was hoping that you could go into greater depth on the Boss 302, and has Peter and your other guests, have they driven it, that Ford Boss 302?
Well, that's
sounds
coming
like
out,
an
March.
Awesome machine. Let's hear more about the 5.0. Just a couple of minutes. Great car. I'm not even a Ford fan.
See, there you go. That's what
we
were saying earlier.
That's Jonathan Brown, one of our favorite guys who always calls.
Well, the Boss 302 comes out in March. And
but last, or at the Dream Cruise.
We had the Boss 302 Laguna Seca, which is just awesome. But the regular 5.0 Mustang is, I think, a significant achievement.
I do, too. Look, it's a modernized platform that still traces its roots back to the old Fox platform that came out in 1979, I want to say, the Mustang one. The interior, all the attachment points, to my eye at least, for the door panels, the instrument panel, everything, goes back to that car. So it's a real nice update of 1979, but they need to gut that thing completely and start from scratch to get the interior right, my opinion. But even so, boy, that car is so good. I mean, the fit and finish on it, the way everything goes together, it is just so impressive to me that if you just go back 3-4 years ago, the Mustang wasn't nearly this good. And just as when Ford did the refresh of the Fusion, you know, the sales just took off on it, got all kinds of rave reviews. I think they've achieved exactly the same, only better with the Mustang. Okay, hey, we got another question from one of the students right here.
My name is Jake Pruitt. I'm from Northwood University. And I guess my question is about the Ford Fiesta. In recent racing news, we see Tanner Faust driving an all-wheel drive Ford Fiesta to a victory in Rallycross. And we also see big names like Ken Block driving an all-wheel drive Fiesta. What is the probability of seeing an all-wheel drive Fiesta in the near future?
They're going to do a sport version of the Fiesta, but I think you're going to see the real ultra sport version in the smaller Ford be in the Focus that's coming out next spring. Yeah. Yeah. There will be an ST version of the Focus. I think they're going to show it in Paris.
Hmm.
That's going to come here. But if we ever see an all-wheel drive, super honking Focus or small Ford, it'll be a Focus, and that's the platform.
I'd love to see it. One of the problems, you know, we talked about before, too, is that America hasn't really warmed up to small cars, despite what the environmentalists and the EPA want you to believe.
And things are in the works to correct
that. They are. But when you talk about the ST or the RS, all-wheel drive Fiesta, I'm guessing you're probably going to be looking at something in Europe. I'll bet you it's priced in the $35,000 range, maybe even more than that. I don't think America's ready for it in enough numbers to justify doing a program like that here. I'm all for it. I would love to drive that car. I think it is so cool, and I think it would put such a halo on the Fiesta here. But it all goes back to what we were talking about before, profitable market share. Mm-hmm. And you could lose your ass coming out with a car like that if there wasn't enough demand to support it.
Yeah.
We have too much variety here in the States.
Right.
We will see an ST
Focus. Great
question.
Focus, very good question.
We will see an ST Focus here.
Okay, let's bring in another phoner.
Hi, this is Fiasco De Vega in Wisconsin. I was wondering why, if Ford is so interested in younger buyers, they're not offering a two-door Fiesta or a two-door Focus. Thank you.
Two doors alienate someone that's got a kid. And it's not just
two doors sell very well in the American market.
Not really. Two doors.
Isn't that the real answer?
It's very niche.
You can get a two-door current Focus. It's the next generation.
Correct.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, the same argument with hatch. Why doesn't hatch? I mean, I've wagons and hatches here.
What Focus is all in the hatch.
Absolutely.
Right. But wagons, you know, we all in the media here love all the sport wagons, love them, and nobody buys them. Nobody.
Yeah.
I mean, it's...
Mazda pulled the plug on the six wagon, and I was like, no.
So, good question, but that's why. People just don't buy them. I think we got some more phone calls here, too. Ben, let's bring in the next.
Hello. Name is Bob Longmate, West Babylon, New York. In reference to your information on Alan Mulally, I don't know if too many people knew that obviously he was in charge of the 787 project, and actually he did a lot of the design work on Boeing's relatively new aircraft with their instrument panels. So as a result, he's very fluent as far as the digital instrumentation. And he's transferring it to Ford, one Ford worldwide. Thank you.
Also, Alan is an engineer.
Aeronautics engineer.
Right.
No, absolutely right. Boy, I tell you, I would not be surprised. I'm not saying it's going to happen. Probably will not happen. But it wouldn't surprise me if, Ford reports mega big profits next year, too. And Boeing says, why don't you come on back and straighten this Dreamliner mess out?
Yeah.
Yeah, I think that Alan will probably get to a point where he's feeling like he's got it running and then move on. I mean, I've had guys tell me they think he's going to run for Congress or something or for Senate because I don't know. I don't know if that's true, but I've had people say that they think that, there's a whole lot going on in terms of the way he responds and reacts.
One thing, I've got a dear friend who's one of the engineers at Ford, and they say the way he talks with employees in Ford, he did at Boeing, that town hall format, but just that incredible approachability and getting the troops rallied in that way, that demeanor of leadership isn't just something that popped up here in Dearborn.
007 Mitch W. says, Lonnie Miller, how do dealers know what customers want?
Yeah.
Why weren't Audi dealers interested in the A1? Where does their intel come from? Their hosiery?
So first of all, dealers are typically going to want what they want if they see the guy down the street selling that something they don't have. That's one. They're getting previews from what the guys at the factory are telling them is coming down the pipeline, so they get excited about that, such as we were talking about Fiat. But when a person comes into the showroom, they said, do you have a two-door? Do you have a hatchback of this and that? And they say, no, we don't have that, or we did, and the inventory's done, or the run's done, and the guy leaves for a customer loss. they're going to bark back to corporate and say, what's up with the product mix? So dealers know their local communities very well, very, very savvy. You're sitting, you know, a Dodge dealer out in Montana, you better have, you know, maybe some V10, you know, trucks sitting on the lot because they've got a heavy hauling, just because they know their market. But they also get excited because they know the pipeline that's coming in. And the factory, frankly, they want to make sure the dealers, you know, are giving them that two-way dialogue on product development.
Susan Marks writes in to say, ask Lonnie his take on these stats. Women buy over 50%. They influence 85% of car buying decisions and have veto power over 95%.
Yes, yes, yes. Point being?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, that's true.
Yeah. Got another phoner in here. Ben, let's bring it in.
Jim from Sioux Falls. Just wondering if your guest has ever done any research on how the name of a car affects sales. For example, there's some cars that maybe are fairly decent little cars like the Suzuki Kizashi, but with a name like that or the Phaeton or the Volkswagen Touareg, if the car has a weird name, does that scare buyers away? Thanks, bye.
Yeah, good question. Haven't done any. Done a lot of case study reviews on sales and looking at what the brand and what the car company was really doing, but funny names. Hopefully the advertising is going to overcome it and just make the image there. You know, classics example, Chevy Nova in Mexico.
Bad idea.
Bad idea when Nova means no go. And sales, you know, it's a classic one. But you've got to think about the image of the car and then just get that repetition. So, you know, clunky names, you've got to associate it somehow with something else other than the name itself.
And doesn't the name kind of go demographically, too? Like, yeah. You know, what the cars that he's naming are the smaller cars that the younger kids are more likely to get involved with. The younger kids aren't concerned necessarily with that. Or if it is, they think it's cool and it's, you know, it's out of the mainstream.
What's amazing to see is when a car company has a generational vehicle and then they say, well, we're kind of tired of that, so we change the name, but they still try to put the same sheet metal on the wheels. And you're like, you just threw that away. I mean, you know, GM was thinking about maybe the SRX changing, you know, names. And it's like hotcakes. And it's like, why would you do that? Don't do that just because you did a fantastic redesign on it. Mm-hmm. So how many years of Camry and Accords have there been? You don't get that naming remorse when the luxury brands have these alphanumeric type of, you know, hard names to go after.
My favorite naming remorse incident happened in the last, I don't know, 6 or 8 months when the GM had been selling the Aveo. And then I went to the auto show, and Mark Royce called it the Avio. what car are you talking about? And they changed the accent on it. And so now I've been very attuned to, okay, Royce says it, and some of the upper guys do it, but then you go and talk to the guys in the building, and it's still the Aveo.
Right, very phonetic.
But they're playing around with just the pronunciation of the car, the name of the car.
Well, remember the Toyota Celica? Mm-hmm. In Canada, they pronounce it Celica. And, you know, one of the things here of living in Detroit is we get Canadian television. Mm-hmm. And so I'm watching TV one day, and an ad comes on for the Toyota Celica, and I went, what the hell? You know, when did they change that? And I called Toyota, and they said, we don't call it that. And I said, I heard an ad, and they said, oh, Detroit, you heard one of the Canadians. So, yeah, I mean, same name can be produced, pronounced very differently. Even amongst English-speaking people.
Yes. Well, and I think that they were, I had the impression that they were going with the Avio as a way to give it a little panache that it didn't have the week before, which to me was hilarious.
Okay, we're going to make this the last question. And actually, I think this is a question that came in last week that we didn't get to, but you might deal with this. Phil Hopewell, we're getting to your question now. Could you ask your guest, what percentage of customers pay full list? What, pay over list? Who come in? How many come in prepared with their research? You know, the cost of the vehicle and all that sort of things. Any reaction to that? You guys got any data?
No hard data. The one thing we do know is that because of all the tools that we're equipped with when we go in to start negotiating, I'd say it's 0% willing to pay full list, and unless you've got some enthusiasts. So take Tesla, the Roadster. Okay, limited volume, but you know some of these very niche, small performance vehicles that are appealing to just, you know, off-the-chart buyer groups. No problem there. But that doesn't count. That's not the case. Who's doing their homework and shopping and wanting to know what the dealer margin is or percent over invoice or under invoice if they do? And even take yourself outside of Detroit with all the employee programs, friends and family thing. Most people are not wanting to pay full list. Economically makes sense, but for those ultra-luxury performance vehicles, that's where you might find some of that, but no deal.
Good. Well, we're at the end here. Let's wrap it up. But Lonnie Miller, thanks so much for coming
in.
It's been great.
Fabulous.
Yeah, Rod Maloney, great having you here,
thank
too.
You. It's fun to come by.
Yeah, and Peter, as always.
Thanks, John.
We always need a little auto-extremism every week in our life, let me tell you. And remember, all of you out there, you can follow us on Facebook all the time. We're at facebook.com/AutolineDetroit. You can follow us on Twitter, twitter.com/AutoLine. Can follow Peter at autoextremist.com or twitter.com/autoextremist. And Rod, WDIV.com.
Yeah, clickondetroit.com is our website. I don't blog about the industry as much as I probably ought to, but we do have car sections there, and my colleague Guy Gordon, who they call the car guy, because he's got nothing better to do. I'm working. You know? And I'd say that to
guy,
his face.
Car guy.
They call him the car guy. So if you want to read up on our version of it, yeah, clickondetroit.com. Good stuff.
And
we have two resources, blog.polk.com. We blog weekly. We've got a lot of avid auto folks. And then polk.com, got a great resource center. So for those of you looking at published research and other commentary, it's
all 140
there.
Years of it, right?
All of it. No dust.
Real good. And remember, you can always get us on Stitcher on your smartphone and BlackBerry. And also remember, we are not going to be here next week in honor of Labor Day week. We're taking off just next Thursday. So thanks, everybody, for having tuned in.
Visit our website, AutolineDetroit.tv, where you can watch us live Thursday nights at 7 p.m. Eastern, get your daily automotive news fix with AutoLine Daily, and in-depth analysis and interviews with AutoLine Detroit. That's all there and much more at AutolineDetroit.tv.
Auto Line After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone, passion for excellence.